Edward Said's 1978 book, Orientalism, dramatically shifted how people think about the production of knowledge and representations of the other. His ideas have been championed and critiqued, with dozens of books expanding his work on the construction of the East in Western imagination. However, very rarely have we investigated the dual move of representing the other and self-representation from the other perspective. In his new book, Arab Occidentalism, Images of America in the Middle East, Eid Muhammad has undertaken this task. With great success, he offers a portrait of the shifting attitudes towards America and American culture in the Arab imagination in the post-9/11 media landscape. He found that Arab cultural producers have a complicated relationship with America, seeing it as problematic while also often representative of their own values. Muhammad delineates how this debate unfolds in literature, cinema, and news media. In our conversation, we explore the dynamics of Occidentalism through Arabic novels about Egyptians living abroad in the United States, news depictions of the 2008 shoe-throwing event with President George W. Bush in Iraq, the reactions to the election of Barack Obama, the Egyptian film industry, and contemporary Arab-American literary products. Thanks again for listening to New Books in Islamic Studies. I'm one of your co-hosts, Christian Peterson, and without further ado, here's my conversation with Eid Muhammad. Thank you for joining me on New Books in Islamic Studies. I'm very excited to talk to you about this wonderful book, Arab Occidentalism, Images of America in the Middle East. But before we get there, it's our tradition here at New Books in Islamic Studies to start with a little bit about you and how you became interested in the study of Muslim societies. So can you take a moment to tell us a little bit about your background and training, perhaps influential mentors or moments that you had that led you to study the things that you do?
Thank you so much for inviting me to be part of this interesting activity about new books. And with regard to my story with this book, which is actually that it was my dissertation for the PhD I got from George Washington University. The story started in 2003, and I was a research assistant at Al Azhar University in Egypt. I was invited by Fulbright to attend a workshop, a summer institute, and it was about American studies. And a group of George Washington University scholars were coming from the U.S. to Egypt to teach us about American studies. What is American studies? And it was a 2 weeks workshop where I met my advisor later on. She became my advisor in the PhD, Melanie McChrystal. And the whole issue was about how to define America and how to look at America. And after the workshop, I started talking to myself about that. And at that time, I also was very interested in Edward Said and his book about Orientalism and following up his writings about Orientalism. So from there, it started my interest in studying America. And in 2005, I submitted an application for George Washington for a PhD in American Studies. I started late in 2006. And my interest was in studying Orientalism and focusing on how the U.S. media culture in general represented Arabs and Muslims. But after spending 2 years at George Washington and studying many, many courses about related to Orientalism and the Orientalist works, I looked at the other side and how Arabs and Muslims look at America. And I found rarely any books written by Arabs who look at the Middle East and how the image of the U.S., especially after 9/11 attacks, how the U.S. is represented there. Really, I find a few articles, and it was not complete works focusing on this aspect of study. At this time, also, I got the opportunity to work for Gallup organization when they were working, conducting polls in different Arab and Islamic states, looking at how Muslims and Arabs look at America and how they envision America after 9/11, especially with the question proposed by George W. Bush, why do they hate us, blah, blah, blah. So I looked at the polls conducted by Gallup, and I found the results are a little bit different than what many, many Americans think at that time, because Muslims and Arabs responded to these polls by saying, we don't hate America, actually. We like them. We like their technology, their democracy, blah, blah, blah. But what we don't like about America is their policy in the Middle East. And from there, it started my interest. This was around 2009, 2010, when I was finishing my coursework. So I told Melanie, I changed my mind. I'm going to focus right now on Occidentalism rather than Orientalism. And this is how it started, the story with writing this dissertation. And after I finished my PhD, I spent 2 years working on trying to make some kind of updating, especially I finished in 2011. And in 2011, started the Arab Spring, which also contributes to, in my belief, it contributes to correcting the image of Arabs and Muslims in the mind of many, many Americans, especially with the Orientalist approach towards Arabs being incapable of making a change. But the Arab Spring came to respond to this Orientalist viewpoint by saying that, yes, they can make the change. Arabs can make the change. And they don't need the American troops to go to Iraq or to go to this part of the world to make this change happen. Arabs themselves, they can make the change. So, I'm not sure if I answered your question, this is how it happens.
Wonderful. Now, this key term here, Occidentalism, that you're using in the title and the major theme of the book, represents this dual move of representation, both of the other and then matters of self-representation. Can you talk a little bit about how you're defining and using this term, Occidentalism, and what do you see as the general operations in Arab cultural products of this idea of Occidentalism?
As I said before, my interest in the topic started from Orientalism by Edward Said. So when I started trying to theorize or to find a theory to depend on for writing my book about Occidentalism, it was actually Edward Said Orientalism. But when I started, I was just making some kind of a conversation with Edward Said. Telling him, Edward, it's not like that. It's Arabs were not passive, were not looking at the way they are represented in the Western culture while they keep silent. It's not the case. They are actually doing something also equal or similar to Orientalism, but on the other side, looking at the West, looking at the Americans, especially in the second half of the 20th century, when America became very involved in the Middle East, and they also make some kind of representation. They also created some kind of stereotypes about Americans, and even the images of the West in the Arab mentality that was in the beginning of the 20th century was connected to the English, the French, the Italians, the old occupiers of certain parts of the Arab world. They were replaced with images about Americans. Jokes about English soldiers in Egypt, for example, were replaced with jokes about American soldiers in Iraq or in Afghanistan. So, but at the same time, I usually look at Orientalism as not as one whole body, which is totally negative, or it's not like that, because there are many Orientalists who came to this part of the world and spent many, many years and went back to their countries to tell nice stories about those people. So in Arab Occidentalism, Image of America in the Middle East, I try to explore how the Egyptian, especially the Egyptian culture, the Arab culture in general, but especially the Egyptian, asserts the value of America as a potential model. And this was asserted or became confirmed after the election of Barack Obama and with his logo about change. And at this time, Arabs were also trying to negotiate their position internationally. And just a few years before Obama, there were started many, many like social movements, especially in Egypt, which tried to explore potential opportunities for change to happen. So I my research engages with many popular artifacts that contribute to the perception of the other. And the choice of these texts, whether they are literary, filmic, journalistic, etc., were based on their popularity as best-selling novels, for example, blockbusters, movies, and articles written by well-known journalists in Egypt or in the Arab world. And the main element I depended on while choosing these texts is their engagement with the U.S. Middle East encounter, especially after 9/11 and especially after the election of Obama. Why Egypt? This might be a question. Why did I choose Egypt? Because, of course, being Egyptian, this will help me a lot, finding the materials I need, visiting the country many times during conducting my research and looking at things on land. But also Egypt is a major cultural and political center in the Arab world. And we know that Egypt is the home of one of the history's first great civilizations. And it has a very strong Islamic traditions. It has a very strong cosmopolitan nature. And it has a very strong also modern pan-Arab political and intellectual history. So its regional leadership gives enhance to its standing as being the cultural capital of the Arab world. So that's why I choose Egypt as the main fountain of the cultural text I chose in, for my book.
And you do a wonderful job of selecting texts that are representative and illuminating in terms of what they reveal about kind of the Arab social imagination of the U.S. And you, in the first chapter, you begin this looking at post 9/11 Arab fiction. But you also do a really good job of kind of setting us up with perspectives about 20th century Arab literature in general. So could you give us just kind of a brief snapshot of some of the shifting attitudes towards America and American culture over that 20th century? And then how does that change in the novels that you look at in a post 9/11 literary world?
Let me start by giving like some kind of like overview of the whole book, how I can make some kind of harmony between different texts I have in the book, between novels. Even I have a chapter on Arab American, and I have a novel and some poems also included in this chapter. So I have poetry, I have novels, I have journalism, I have films in the same book. So the book attempts actually to negotiate two realities, the history of Orientalism and Occidentalism, this is on one hand, and the longing of many Arabs to create terms of mutual understanding and connection between the U.S. and the Middle East on the other hand. And I'm going back to Orientalism because this is how it starts with the idea in my mind. So in Orientalism, Ojibwa Sayyid states that the West underwent some kind of Orientalization and was transformed into a stereotype over centuries by religious wars, literary depictions, and the scholarly discourse, the body of knowledge, which in the end constituted what we know as Orientalism. Do we have the same thing in the Arab world? Do we have a group of texts from different directions, from literature, from film studies, from journalism, which in the end constitute a body of knowledge about America, and we can call it Occidentalism? This is what I tried, or my book delves into these questions, trying to inform the relationship between the Arab self and the American other, as represented in this book. So in the first chapter, in the chapter about the novels, the one you mentioned, I chose two novels. One of them takes place in New York, New York City, the other one in Chicago. And both cities, they do have a good number of Arabs living there. In New York, I believe the largest Egyptian community is in New York, in New Jersey, like in New York area, if I add New Jersey to New York area. And in Chicago also there is a big Arab community living there. So the first one is dealing with the Sunni-Shia issue, Birds of the South by Amani Abul Fadl, which won the Arabic, won the award of the best Arabic novel in 2004 or 2005, I'm not sure. The novel is taking this dispute between Arabs themselves, like Sunni or Shia, and between Muslims also, Muslims who are Sunni and Muslims who are Shia, taking this dispute to the American soil, to the American land, and discussing it there, trying to see if we have the same, like in the Arab world, if we have the same democracy, the same freedom, the same values in America happen here in the Arab world, will it be solved? Will the issue be solved? And as we do have stereotypes about the West, as we do have stereotypes about the United States, Arabs themselves are divided into Sunni and Shia, and each group has its own stereotypes about the other. And what was the way out of that? It was actually by facing each other, by starting to talk to each other. So when they started to talk to each other, they discovered that there are many, many stereotypes there which were not true. And they even became ready for the next step, which is to get united. And in this story, they get united through marriage. So the hero in this novel is someone coming from Egypt, working as a physical therapist in the United States, which, by the way, in New York, there are many, many Egyptian physical therapists living there. And I have some of my friends who are physical therapists in New York. So I'm not sure if the novelist chose this kind of job because she lived in New York for some time or not. Anyway, he comes from Egypt. He comes even from the most conservative part of Egypt, which Upper Egypt and Upper Egypt. He's coming from Luxor. So he's coming from a very conservative society where he has some kind of assumptions about Shia. And he lived with this Shia family, and he noticed that they are very religious, which he likes about them. And after some time, he discovered that they are Shia. And to him, to the way he was trained to believe that Shia are more dangerous than any other group, than even non-Muslims. So he became like very, very upset about living with them in the same building, and he started to take himself away from this relationship. But after some time, the questions he raised and he was able to discuss with those people wipes away all the words he has in mind about this group of Muslims, about Shia. In the second novel, it's Ali Al-Aswani, Chicago. And Ali Al-Aswani, he lived in Chicago for 3 years, I believe. So his novel is based on some kind of personal experience in Chicago. And he was also discussing some kind of internal issues in Egypt, which is when Egyptians were sent abroad to study abroad and the kind of relationship they have with each other and their relationship to the state as well. And he believes that Egypt under Mubarak was as a dictatorship was monitoring the activities of those Egyptians while studying abroad because they might constitute a threat to the regime in Egypt. So he was trying to follow up these kind of relationships between Egyptians and themselves and the different characters they represent. And those are the scholars who are studying in the U.S. right now to go back to Egypt in the future and become the leaders of the country. So it gives us some kind of an insight into how Egypt looks like in the future. Even if those are very well-educated scholars, when they go back and they leave their country, this is how they act. This is how their personalities are like. So this is what I, so in both novels, actually, we bring issues of internal issues from the Arab world to happen in on the American land and to try to discuss it. As if those scholars or those novelists, I mean, Ali Al-Aswani or Amal Abul Falk, found the American land a very useful place to use to tackle our problems. And this shows how Arabs in general look at America as a model for change.
That's a good segue into your second chapter, which looks at Arab news media kind of in a broad sense, but then zooms into these two moments, the 2008 yeah. Moment when a reporter threw a shoe at then-President Bush, which is just a fascinating story in and of itself, and then how you look at that is really amazing. And then the election of Barack Obama, which you mentioned already, this kind of idea of hope and change was very inspirational. So what did you find when you were looking at the kind of news media more generally?
Yeah, as I said, the book was trying to look at a body of knowledge in general. And, of course, media constitutes or makes a large portion in this regard. And I was like very interested in looking at news stories and how readers in Egyptian newspapers, how readers responded to these news stories, especially news stories about America. So why I chose these two incidents when Nasser Zaidi threw his shoes on George W. Bush during his visit to Iraq, and how some Arabs started like paid this as being a victory achieved by an Arab against the U.S. who occupied Iraq at that time, and the other incident was the election of Barack Obama. What is the relation between the two incidents? I still believe that if we don't have George W. Bush, we don't have Obama as a president. So I think that the kind of hatred proposed by the U.S. at at the hands of the U.S., the former U.S. President George W. Bush, when he started to talk about why do they hate us, when he used the word crusades in his speech, blah, 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 all of these words of hate, especially that the war of Iraq was proven later that it was not needed because the weapons he talked about was not there. So you invaded a country, you destroyed a nation just because of some assumptions you have in your mind about your role as a Christian who should come to this part of the world and set people free and spread your values, blah, blah, blah. So Arabs were talking about the same stuff, and they were worried about the same things. And they were even, and this is what we will talk about in the movies, they were also worried about this to happen to another Arab country, to happen to Egypt, to have Tunisia, or any other Arab country. So they started to look at Bush as a person who is trying to push America to get more undesired or unfavored involvement in the Middle East. And they think that this person is the one to be hated. And throwing the journalist who throws his shoes on George W. Bush, and in the Arab culture, throwing a shoe on someone is a symbol of disrespect, is a symbol of hate, is a symbol of being a person who is not like welcomed by people in their place, like in their house or in their homeland. So it was a symbolic message, and it when I followed up the news stories about this incident, I noticed how people are happy with it, and most talks there were not about America as a state, but about a person who is named George W. Bush, who is responsible for what the mess we are witnessing right now in Iraq. And this person, if he continues to be, or if he, I know he, in 2008, he was leaving the White House, but people like always look at presidents, especially in the Arab world, they are trained to have presidents for 30, 40 years. So they look at those people as being like, they will be the everlasting presidents of these nations. So they think that if George W. Bush or someone like him is there in the White House, this will harm the relationship between Arabs and the U.S. more and more. And that's why I chose the other incident is to be the election of Obama. Why Obama? Because this is a totally different, looks like U.S. president. He doesn't look like a U.S. president from what we used to have in the past. He looks like us. He has a middle name, an Arabic middle name. So people started, and he's coming to say, yes, we can make a change, blah, blah, blah. So these words actually address what the Arabs have in mind and what they think about. Starting, as I said, this has started with workers' movements in 2005 in Kifaya, a social movement, and other movements that started in Egypt, looking for some kind of freedom and democracy, and calls for the same values Americans believe in. So Obama came at the right time and came to call for the same things Arabs and Egyptians in particular were looking for. So they started to believe in themselves more with the election of Obama. So Obama was elected in the U.S., but he gives hope to those nations in the Arab world that they can achieve this change. And one of the articles I have in the book is written by Ibrahim Issa, a very famous journalist in Egypt. And he was making this nice comparison between or like making some kind of fictional story about the father of Obama, Barack Obama, Mr. Hussein Obama, coming to Egypt before traveling to the U.S. And he married an Egyptian girl from Mansoura, an Egyptian city famous for its beautiful girls. So he married a very beautiful Egyptian girl. And they gave birth to their son, whom they named Mabruk. And because this marriage was not actually welcomed by the family, so there were many, many problems between between them. So Barack, Mr. Hussein Obama, decided to travel to the U.S. and leave his wife and leave his son, and he traveled to the U.S., where he married a white American girl and got Barack. And the end of the story, Ibrahim Issa is making a comparison actually between Barack and Mabruk. Mabruk was born in Egypt, raised up in Egypt. And he said in the end of this article, he said that actually Barack became president of the United States while Mabruk is still fighting to get the Egyptian citizenship. And this kind of comparison between between imagining Mr. Hussein Obama coming to Egypt and having a son there and going to the U.S. and having a son there and the future of these two sons, how it looked like after many, many years, is because he ends up this article by saying the only condition to become a president in Egypt is not to have the citizenship or not to have Hussein Obama as your father or not to have Barack as your brother in the U.S. It's to have Mohammed Hosni Mubarak or Hosni Mubarak, the president of Egypt, as your father. And he was referring to Gamal Mubarak, who was supposed to be the president after his death during that time. So all of these news stories about the two incidents were showing the two things I talked about in the beginning about what this book is trying to do. Our position with regard to the history of Orientalism and Occidentalism is shown in the incident of throwing a show on U.S., on the U.S. president, which is George W. Bush. We don't like your involvement in our region. We don't want you to get involved in this, and we hate your act in this. While showing in the second incident, choosing or election of Barack Obama and welcoming it and thinking that this will be the source of hope for a change in the Arab world, is doing actually the second thing, which is looking at America as a model of for change and looking at America as a source of hope in this regard. So two Americas in the same chapter, two Americas actually in the same book, the America we don't like, which is in agreement with the polls, not only by Gallup, many, many other organizations, but Gallup, like one of the most trusted organizations in the U.S. It comes to make this kind of agreement with these polls that we don't like American policy in the Middle East, but we like the American values, the American democracy, the American freedom. We like them most, and we think that they are a source of hope for us as well.
You also explore this relationship between the U.S. and the Middle East through Egyptian film. Can you tell us a little bit about how this relationship, this East-West encounter, is imagined through Arab cinema in a post 9/11 world?
I try to analyze the ways in which Egyptian films attempt to demonstrate that the oppressed, the excluded, and the dominant pose a constant threat to any dialogue between the United States and the Arab world. So these films show like some kind of gaps in that discourse between the U.S. and the Arab world. First of all, it usually, all of these films deal with this kind of controversial discourse emphasize the centrality of the Arab-Israeli conflict, and the war in Iraq is added after 2003. And not only that, but also the anti-Arab sentiment that swept America after 9/11. So these three issues were discussed in many films that dealt with this kind of discourse between the U.S. and the Arab world after 9/11. The first movie is The Night Baghdad Fell. And this movie, it's also like a very factional story. It tackles both issues. If you look, if the reader looks very deep into while reading this book, he will find that the two things I emphasized at the beginning of the book are running together throughout the whole thing, the whole chapters, every single chapter, every single story in this book is telling the same thing, which is the looking at the internal issue, what Arabs are suffering from in their, if I'm focusing on the Egyptian case, what Egyptians are suffering from in their own country, lacking of freedom from democracy, suffering from corruption, suffering from the absence of all these values that people cherish in the United States. And at the same time, their fear, their hatred, their the way they look at the American policy in the Middle East. So in this movie, it's a fictional story about a school headmaster who is imagining that what happened to Iraq at the hands of American soldiers will happen also in Egypt. So he got some nightmares about Americans coming to Egypt to invade Egypt and destroy his city. He lives in Cairo and rape his daughter, doing stuff that happened in Abu Ghraib. And so he had this in mind. He decided, and this shows how Egyptians at that time are looking at their country, are looking at their government, are looking at their administration, that they are absent from the scene. He decided to find a way to defend his country against the American occupation. He started to look, and he, as a school headmaster, he knows a lot of his students who are brilliant, especially in science, and he started to recall the names of those students. And he recalls one of them who was very genius in science. And he decided to go and look for him. And this is how the story started. He brings this young man and told him, I'm going to let you marry my daughter. I give you money. I do whatever you want. But you have to work hard to invent a weapon that can be used to prevent the American invasion of Egypt. And from there, the story started. And from time to time, he's haunted by these nightmares, which recalls pictures and images Egyptians have about America from Abu Ghraib, the pictures released from Abu Ghraib, and the pictures that came in the media about Americans shooting Iraqis in the streets. Blah. So they have this in mind as well. And the images they have in mind about Baghdad were automatically transferred into their minds about the same images about Cairo. If it happens, an American invasion of Cairo, there will be these images of deconstruction everywhere. So this is the first movie. The second movie is also tracing the two threats I mentioned earlier. It's about how terrorism is created and how Americans are thinking, how many Americans throw what is represented in the media, in the films, how they imagine terrorism is created and is emanates from. And this movie is called Baby Don't Night, trying to get Egyptian Americans involved in this as well. So it's about a group of Americans coming from New York to visit Cairo, and it has one Egyptian American who is like having a tourist company, and he's the one who is leading this trip to Cairo, and his friend was a journalist who went to Iraq to cover the war there and was imprisoned in Abu Ghraib, suffered from torture at the hands of Americans, and he turned to be a terrorist. Later on, he became a terrorist. He was a friend of the guy who was Egyptian-American and who is working for working in the field of tourism right now. So one became involved in tourism in the U.S. The other one became a terrorist in the field of terrorism in Egypt after he suffered from the torture at the hands of Americans in Abu Ghraib. And from there, the story and the two threads work together. The guy who is coming, the Egyptian-American who is coming from America, he's looking at America as a source of freedom and democracy, blah, blah, blah. And he's trying to represent the same image to his fellow Egyptians. And the other one who suffered from Americans in Iraq is bringing another or a different image of America to tell people about it. So the two threads are running together throughout the whole book, and this is how it works in the chapter about the movies.
The last chapter you have is an interesting one because it looks not at Arabs coming from the Middle East, but Arab Americans and how what kind of cultural responses they have in the post 9/11 United States context. So what do you see in contemporary Arab-American literary products in terms of how do they navigate this hybridity, this hybrid identity of both being Arab and being an American? How do they navigate that? How do they communicate what these identities mean to them? And how do you see this fitting into this idea of Occidentalism?
When I started writing my book, I was not like at the beginning I was not interested in including Arab Americans in this book because I thought that this is a book about Arab Occidentalism. This is how Arabs who live in the Arab world are imagining America. Why should I include a chapter about Arab American literary texts? But I was interested in how Arab Americans are trying to bridge the gap between their being Arab and their being American at the same time, and how they themselves are actually represented, whether in America, in their homeland right now, or when they visit the Arab world, how their fellow Arabs look at them as at the same time. I was very interested in emails from Shahrazad by Mogakar, where she creates some kind of a representational space from the legendary Thousand and One Nights stories, which is very familiar whether in the Arab world or in the West, to thematize the hardships faced by Arab minorities in the United States. This was very interesting for me because what Shahrazad did in Thousand and One Nights is that she actually saved all other women from being slaughtered by telling stories to the king. And what Mogakaf is trying to say in her emails from Shahrazad is that I'm going to use words also to save my fellow Arabs in the U.S. from this wave of hatred that happened after 9/11. So Mogakaf depicts the lives of those who are not heard within the normative national discourse of both, not only the United States, it's both, the United States and the Arab world. And her work calls for a return to a self-supporting Arab woman, for a move towards independence, and for the rejection of a male role. So by returning to tradition and self-reliance of the past, emails from Shahrazad showed that Arab American women have much to offer to the United States in the post 9/11 attacks. By restoring the tradition while reconciling it with the effects of modernity. So the American Shahrazad, in emails from Shahrazad by Mogakaf, uses her traditional ways of the past to create a modern mirror of herself. And this is very important, whether for her being an American or her being also partially an Arab. So in both parts of the world, in both areas, on both regions, this is much needed. In the second work of art I used in this chapter by Leila Halabi, her novel, Once in a Promised Land. This book is doing a good job in emphasizing how the past informed the present. And how after 9/11, the world that the American dream and the nice world that Arabs live in the U.S. Becomes for many of them a futureless wallet. And it details how some Arab Americans face some kind of damage when they do experience the absolute freedom they have in the U.S. So it tells the story of those who immigrate to the U.S. and get rid of their cultural heritage and started to get immersed in the melting pot, the American melting pot, and this damaged their own personality, their own heritage, their own cultural heritage. So in both works of art, the issue of identity is revisited, and it's revisited from the perspective of those hyphenated personalities of the novelist and the poet. And this kind of conflict being American and being an Arab at the same time, it becomes another a source for another conflict going on within the personalities of the heroine Salwa in The Promised Land, or Shahrazad in Emails from Shahrazad. So Leila Halabi in the novel, she focuses on the small familiar space within which she tries to investigate the post-colonial dilemma. In that way, the globalization has come to explain the hybrid nature of Arab American writers. And there is a third national or local dimension, a new cultural hybrid integrating the two national cultures, Arab and American, through a process of some kind of cognitive and emotional identity or entity. So in this way, I find the Arab Americans are trying to create some kind or construct some kind of alternative identities and focus on the moment they can, their identity is constructed within the constraints of history and time, whether the history of Arab Americans in the U.S., or whether the history of Arabs themselves, like the history of women in the Arab world, the history of so many things that constitute some kind of obstacles on the way to freedom and on the way to so many good values, they experience it in the U.S. So they became like torn between these two identities, and they try to imagine some kind of a third identity, a third space between the two worlds.
Well, you've explained all this with great clarity here, and I would encourage listeners to get the book, because you do even a better job in the book itself, and both kind of laying out the visual imagery of these texts and films that you're examining and your analysis as well. So thank you for that.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Before we let you go, though, can you tell us a little bit about the things you're working on now or have lined up in the future? Are we going to have more Arab Occidentalism to look forward to from your work, or are you moving in new directions?
I'm actually right now. I have a project that has been awarded the Qatar Foundation research grant, and this book about transcultural identities, when I look at the contemporary Arab social movements and the central research question for this project are, like, how do new media, film, and literary or artistic forms of expression inform and echo currents of transformation in the Arab world, especially after the Arab Spring? And how do such forms theorize transcultural identity as a form of citizen engagement at the center of transformation politics in the Arab world? So the project attempts to present a unique attempt to investigate forms of cultural production as new modes of knowledge that shed light on the nature of social movements with the aim of expanding the critical reach of the disciplinary methods of political discourse and social theory. It's a bit focusing on the Arab world at this time, focusing on not the U.S. Arab world relationship. It's totally focusing on the Arab world. I'm trying to seek to articulate systematically the ways in which the Arab scene can contribute to the understanding of the rise of new social movements worldwide. So in this way, I'm studying how the Arab world is actually filling through what happened in the Arab Spring is filling some kind of methodological gaps in the dominant Western discourse and theories about the constitution of how Arab social movements or how social movements in general could be studied or explored. So in this book, I'm doing some kind of a comparative look at instead of like focusing on a single case study, I'm looking at different cases. I'm taking Egypt, Tunisia, Yemen, and of course Syria, and looking at how these revolutionary momentous in specific Arab countries highlight the role of like new kind of discourse, new kind of knowledge, new kind of cultural production that happened after the Arab Spring. So this is my current work, and it will, one of the deliverables is a book that will be within 2 years from now, hopefully.
Yes. Well, congratulations on that very prestigious award, and good luck on the project. It sounds excellent.
Thank you so much.